Good evening. Can everyone hear me out there? Terrific. Welcome to the second night of our annual town meeting. My name is Myron Fox. I'm privileged to be your moderator tonight, and I'm calling this meeting to order. There is a quorum present, and I so declare. The coffee and snacks are being provided this evening by Sudbury Destination Imagination, which is an educational program in which teams compete in problem-solving challenges that emphasize creative thinking, risk-taking, and teamwork. This year, Sudbury has two teams that each won first place in the state tournament and will compete at the global tournament with teams from 50 states and 40 countries. The Sudbury teams are raising money to support their travel to this tournament to be held at the University of Tennessee later in May. Please, please, please turn off your cell phones. Also, please give your name and address clearly each time you speak in order to ensure that our record of this proceeding is accurate. Also, we have Boy Scouts tonight who will bring you mics. When you, what people have been doing and have had a few complaints about it, is speaking into the mic with your name and address and then starting to talk either with your hands, in which one has a mic, or just dropping the mic down lower, we can't hear you. So please keep in mind, keep that mic up close to your mouth. If you desire to be recognized, just raise your card, the blue one, from your seat. Please do not stand at the microphone to be recognized. After I recognize you, one of our runners will bring you a mic, regardless of where you're sitting. And then when you receive the mic from the runner, it's already on, so there's no need to blow into it to make sure it's on, because we'll all hear that too. Our thanks go to Dan Vogel, Scoutmaster of Boy Scout Troop 63, who provided us with Robert Pringle, Ricky Rust, and Joe Mooney, who are three Boy Scouts tonight, who will be running the mics for us. Thank you, fellas. If you have a motion to amend, it must be delivered to me before you make it. It must be in writing. It must be in triplicate, because one goes to the ViewGraph, one goes to the town clerk, and one goes to me. Before you make it, I have to make a ruling that your amendment is within the four corners of the article. It's within the scope of the original article. So, again, it has to be in writing, preferably typed, and delivered to me. If it's in electronic form also, even better. Only registered voters of the town and non-resident town employees and elected town officials may speak without leave of the hall. Non-residents are required to sit in the last two seats to the left or the right. If you are moving an article, unless you move in the words of the article as printed in the warrant, every presenter must tell the hall of any word changes in the motion and how they differ from the words that the voters saw in the warrant. Brief reminder, no audible noises, hissing, booing, whistling, clapping, or the like before, during, or after someone is speaking. Speakers may not make disrespectful comments, whether directed at a speaker, presenter, or a town official. I encourage those of you who speak little at town meeting or don't speak at all, please, I'd be delighted to recognize you. In addition, at our town meeting on April, our first night on April 6th, the ViewGraph neglected to mention, as one of our armed services personnel from Sudbury, Captain Brian Mahoney, who graduated from Lincoln Sudbury Regional High School and now is serving our country as a captain in the U.S. Marine Corps. He has returned from Iraq and is about to ship out to Afghanistan. I was asked to remind you that we have materials on warrant articles outside on the table. Also, if you don't have your warrant, we have some extra ones out front, and also we have those handouts for Article 4 up here front. If anyone is sitting in the middle and needs that, please raise your hand and keep your hand up, please. Can one of the scouts, is it a warrant or the handout?
Both.
Anybody else? I see one hand here. You need both over there? A handout in the back. Another one over here. Can you, Scouts, can you come up front? Can you grab a few handouts and a few warrant articles and hand them to anyone who's got their hand raised? Are they gone? Over there. Thank you. Please keep your hands up, and the Boy Scouts will bring them to you. Thank you. Bathrooms are across the hall from the auditorium. Fire Chief Ken McLean asked me to announce that emergency fire exits are at the back of the auditorium and the two doors you came in. They're also through either end of the stage. You may exit through either side of the stage, behind the stage. Yes. Yes. Either color will do the trick. I've been asked to make an announcement about Memorial Day Parade, Monday, May 25th. Starts at the Rugged Bear Plaza on Route 20 at 9:30 a.m. It ends at the Town Center at 10:30. Town program begins at 11 a.m. at Town Hall. Come out and be a part of the American hometown tradition. They also need a trumpeter, if we have any volunteers, a four-door convertible, preferably a Cadillac with big fins, for the parade marshal. If you have any of these things and care to lend them, please call Spencer Goldstein, the commander of the Sudbury Post, at 978-460-2620. If I read that number too fast, he's in the phone book. On April 6, 2009, many moons ago, the first night of our annual town meeting, the hall voted to refer Articles 2 through 8 to the selectmen to gather information relative to state aid to Sudbury and to report back to us tonight. I recognize Selectman Chair Lawrence O'Brien for that report.
Good evening, everyone. As the moderator said, on the evening of April 6th, the last time we met...
Larry, you want to bring that mic a little closer to you? I don't think folks can hear.
Is that better?
No.
Closer still. There you go.
I'll swallow it.
All right. Is that better? I think they turned it on now. Very good. All right. Good evening. Back on April 6th, we, the Board of Selectmen and the Finance Committee, ask you to support a motion to refer budget-related articles for further study. You obliged us, and this evening I am here to report that, unfortunately, the fog of economic uncertainty that I had previously referred to has thickened rather than cleared. Over the past 5 weeks, many things have happened that have not been good for the budget process here in Sudbury. A short list of some of the items include the governor announcing that he will be submitting a revised spending plan based on the substantial reduction in state revenue that has occurred since February 1st. The House of Representatives have released their budget totaling $19.5 billion. The State Department of Revenue announced that April revenue was $450 million below the same point last year, and that year-to-date we are off by $2 billion in revenue collections. The State Senate has announced that their budget will total $17.9 billion based on the reports that they have received from the Department of Revenue. With a difference of $1.6 billion between the House and Senate budgets, Senator Eldridge has advised that cuts to local aid are most likely to be made as part of the House and Senate negotiations as the Budget Conference Committee attempts to deliver to the governor a balanced state budget by July 1st. The Board of Selectmen has received no new information to report to you concerning the arrival date or any amounts of federal stimulus dollars. Local contract negotiations for Lincoln Sudbury Regional High School, Sudbury Public Schools, and the town are ongoing. In April, you will recall that I announced that the town and Sudbury Public Schools would be looking to achieve substantial cost savings through the implementation of a new health insurance plan designed in conjunction with Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Massachusetts. As part of the collective bargaining process, the Sudbury Teachers Association, the Sudbury Firefighters, and the Sudbury Police Unions have all requested extensive and detailed information relative to our current health insurance plans. The Board of Selectmen and the Finance Committee were optimistic about being able to present to you this evening a balanced budget that would have been able to withstand any economic changes that might develop during the new fiscal year. Unfortunately, we are not that confident this evening and do not want to ask you, as the town's legislative body, to make appropriations to the various cost centers that may be greater than the actual revenue and state aid could support. The Finance Committee is obligated to present a balanced budget to town meeting. Given the potential cuts under the non-override budget printed in the warrant, it does not wish to guess at how bad further cuts may be from the Legislative Budget Conference Committee. At the present time, it does not believe the budget in the warrant is balanced any longer. We would prefer to allow the advice of Senator James Eldridge and Representative Tom Conroy and delay action on the budget until everyone can get more clarity from the legislature. It is not as simple as just saying, let's not spend what we don't receive. Municipal finance just doesn't work that way. Whatever town meeting appropriates is available to be spent, whether the funds are actually there or not. While we wouldn't expect that any of the cost centers would spend money that isn't available, there is always the opportunity for mistakes to be made. While irritating as this may be to all of us, as well as yourselves, we respectfully request your additional patience to make sure that we present you with a balanced non-override budget that does not overshoot the cuts that are coming and forces us to not utilize funds that we may actually receive from the state and increase them, that may potentially increase the number of layoffs that the current budget in the warrant already entails. We ask that you support the motion that will be made by the Finance Committee when it is put forth to extend this meeting to June 15th. Thank you.
Thank you. Do I have a motion by the Finance Committee under Article 2?
Yes, Mr. Moderator. Move to refer Article 2 to the Board of Selectmen to determine the effect of the state budget relative to state aid to Sudbury and to report back to this annual town meeting at an adjourned session on June 15th, 2009 for further action on this article.
Does it receive a second? It does. Mr. Woodard, do you care to add anything to Mr. O'Brien's report?
I'm not sure I could add much more than that, other than I think it's a statement of the obvious that if you don't know what your revenues are, you can't come up with a budget. So the Finance Committee strongly supports this.
Thank you. Selectman?
Selectman support the motion.
Thank you. Please raise your card if you wish to be heard on the article. Yes.
Martha Cole, 14 Churchill Street. The title says fiscal year 09 budget adjustment, and the budget we're voting is fiscal year 10. I'd like to know a little bit about the mechanics of what's happening here.
Yeah, town manager.
Yes, thank you. That's a great question. As it was asked in April, we see that all of these financial articles are sort of linked and related by the common denominator here of the state aid. As a matter of fact, the FY09 state budget has huge problems. The superintendents and last week and then myself today were notified that the state is prepared to make substantial cuts in the Chapter 70 program, which is the educational program for fiscal year 09. They have filed legislation, though, to use available federal stimulus money to replace that dollar for dollar under the FY09 budget so that we could remain sort of fiscally one for one in the same place. So upon seeing that, I wrote to Mr. Wolfson, who is the sort of senior finance person in the Department of Education at the state level, and I asked him, can we rely on this, or could this not happen, that we would get this one for one dollars for 09? Could we still have a major FY09 problem? And his response is, the current plan has been filed as a legislative proposal. My expectation is that if the legislature does not act on it, the governor is prepared to make the Chapter 70 cuts unilaterally using his 9C powers. So we could still see cuts in the current year for revenue that we are depending on. Given that, it feels that the same logic that Chairman O'Brien said, we look at FY09 as June 15th may be our last chance to sort of make things right and not end the year on the deficit.
Yes. What's the point of order? Okay. And the question was, why does it say fiscal year 09 and not fiscal year 10? And I think she's trying to explain that now.
This asks for action on the FY 09 budget.
I'm sorry?
This budget, this article here refers to the FY 09 budget.
And that is, Ms. Cole, that is correct. This is the 09 budget we're talking about. These are adjustments to the 09 budget, even though we're going to be talking about fiscal year 2010 when we get to Article 4.
Thank you. The other, I guess I get a little confused because I think that I always thought that you got the cherry sheet in August. And in fact, that was one of my questions I was going to ask later is when we get the cherry sheet in August, is that for the year, the previous year or for the new budget year?
Yes, town manager.
The way the calendar works now is the what's called the cherry sheet that's finalized.
Excuse me, Maureen, you're going to have to bring that mic real close to you.
The way the process works now with the cherry sheet, for those that don't know, that is the document that has the state aid numbers for in each community and regional school system. That is produced by the Department of Revenue upon the conclusion of the budget from the state. And
right.
So typically we see that cherry sheet, the final version, coming out about May, because the conference committee finishes it and the budget is issued. They still haven't sent the cherry sheet at this time. I'm not sure what about August, but that's what we've been used to for the last 10 years.
Okay, well, my days of covering the FinCom are a long time past. Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else wish to be heard on the motion on the view graph on Article 2? Yes, right over here, please.
Jim Negrelli, 51 Penny Meadow Road. I just got a quick question. Is there a chance that these revenue numbers may not be available by June 15th? And if so, will we be asked to reconvene a month from now or 6 weeks from June 15th? Those numbers aren't available.
No, the answer is quite simple. Our fiscal year ends the fiscal year ends June 30. So we must have a budget out by June 30. Is that correct? So the answer is no, it cannot be postponed too much longer beyond June 15th because June 30th is the deadline. My guess is June 15th was chosen because the schools will still be in session and folks won't be away for the summer. Thank you. Anyone else wish to be heard under the motion on the view graph under Article 2? I see none. This is a majority vote on this article, and for every motion to refer that's coming up in Articles 3 through 8, those will also be a majority vote. All those in favor of the motion, as you see in the view graph, signify by raise your cards. Those opposed. There's only a few abstentions. It passes overwhelmingly. We're going to move on to Article 3. Do we have a motion from the Finance Committee?
Move to refer Article 3 to the Board of Selectmen to determine the effect of the state budget relative to state aid to Sudbury and to report back to this annual town meeting at an adjourned session on June 15, 2009, for further action on this article.
Does that receive a second? It does. Finance Committee for a presentation, if you wish. Same?
Same.
Thank you. Selectmen, same?
Same, and we support.
Thank you. Anyone who wished to be heard under the motion in Article 3? I see none. All those in favor signify by raising your cards. Those opposed, it passes unanimously. We're going to go on to Article 4, Finance Committee for motion.
Move to refer Article 4 to the Board of Selectmen to determine the effect of the state budget relative to state aid to Sudbury and to report back to this annual town meeting at an adjourned session on June 15, 2009, for further action.
Further action on this article?
On this article.
Does that receive a second? It does. Finance Committee, the same report?
Same report.
Selectman?
Same.
Thank you. Anybody wish to be heard? Yes, right over there, please stand up.
Dave Jacob, 328 O Lancaster. My question is, with the state in disarray around the budget, it could very well go right to the last minute as well as what we're going through. We could be in the same place June 15th. What steps has the Finance Committee and the budgeting process taken to, we'll have to, at that point, guess a budget is what you're telling me. Is that a true statement? Just I'm trying to understand.
We'll have to work with the numbers we have at the time and ask for approval of those numbers.
My understanding, the purpose of, as stated on August 6th, of moving the second night of town meeting to tonight instead of April 6th, was to see if we could get more information from, we thought that, not we, the Finance Committee, the Selectmen, the Town Manager thought that the numbers from the Senate, the Massachusetts Senate, would be out. They're not out.
And that's, well, my concern is they may not be out June 15th is all.
They're scheduled to be out this week.
Oh, okay. That's what I wanted to know. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Yes. Microphone over there, please. Boy Scouts.
Pulse 220 Old Lancaster Road. Has there been a budget prepared with no state aid, and is it possible to spend the state aid received in 2010 and 2011?
Did you hear that up here?
I heard part of it.
Could you repeat that, and don't hold the mic quite so close?
Has a budget been prepared for the town which does not include any state aid, and is it possible to mark projects for spending of the state aid received in 2009 as contingent on receiving the state aid, presuming that this economy is going to continue to sputter along and they're still not going to know what they're going to do with the local aid at the state level?
First of all, no budget has been prepared assuming no state aid. That would be, I mean, if we get to that point, we'll get to that point, but that would be catastrophic. Secondly, we will... Come June 15th, we'll have to recommend a budget based upon the best available information we have at the time. We'll be as conservative as we can with regard to what we know about revenues. And quite frankly, if we get partway into fiscal year 10 and state aid is even less, we'll then have to go back to each of the cost centers and ask them to reduce their spending.
Yes, can we have a mic right over here, please, right behind you?
Pat Kinney, 107 Goodman Till Road. Two questions. One, we're referring to the selectmen for the state aid. What about the contract negotiations? Is that also something that will be reported back at that point? And what happens if they're not finished? And second, what is the handout that was given to us about Article 4? And is that going to be utilized, or is this motion superseded?
Yeah. Answering your second question first, this motion supersedes that. So that will not be taken up tonight if this motion passes.
And I've got a follow-up question, because in the handout there seems to be a split of the employee benefits lines into contingency funds, which I assume has something to do with the negotiations. And is there any information that can be shared with us regarding that split and what the expectations are for expenditures under that item 1000 that was prepared in the handout?
Mr. O'Brien?
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. I think to be on the safe side, beyond the remarks that I made in my report concerning the additional information that's been requested concerning the health insurance plan, all that we can actually say is that negotiations are ongoing. There's certainly representatives from the town and the schools if they want to add to that with the permission of the moderator, but we're somewhat bound to not discuss the negotiations in public while they're in process.
I'm just a little confused why there's a handout that specifies a motion.
That's a fair question. The handout is that and the point that you make is correct, that the money that would be appropriated to the benefits line has been split into two categories, and a reserve fund known as 1000 has been created. If you recall from April 6th, in my State of the Town address, I made the remarks that savings that would be generated from the change to the health insurance plan would go directly back to either SPS or the town. To make those funds available for fiscal year 10 without having to convene a special town meeting, it is on the advice of town council that the approximate value of the funds that could be potentially generated by the change in health insurance plan be put into the reserve fund. That reserve fund would then only require a vote of the finance committee and the town manager to transfer those funds
to SPS or to the town so that they could be used immediately to preserve the jobs that they were intended to preserve.
Sir, could you just repeat your name and address? The town clerk didn't get it up here.
Sorry, it was Pat Kinney, 107 Goodman Till Road.
Thank you.
And Mr. Moderator, just to go back to the original remark that if this motion passes, we will not be discussing that, but that was the answer for
right.
the...
Yeah, did everyone understand that? The handout, the orange or white handout on Article 4 that hopefully all of you received on the way in, if this motion passes, we won't be taking that up until June 15th. If it fails, then we're going to take that up right now. Okay? Anybody else wish to be heard? Yes. Mike, right there, please.
Roger Nichols, 220 Old Lancaster Road. Is there a means of marking budget items to be spent only in event that we get state aid, thinking of, which I presume is all capital items?
Hey, did you catch the question, Maureen?
Town Council may have to respond to that. We looked at the stabilization fund, for instance. Could we fund that on a contingent basis for state aid? And it, once you make an appropriation, whether it's state aid or local receipts, it takes effect. But that's, Paul, I think that's something maybe, can you address that?
Well, I think I could probably address it, but I didn't hear his whole, I didn't understand the whole question. Would you mind repeating it?
Is it possible to make a list of items in the budget which will be spent only if we receive state aid?
Is it possible?
So to make up stuff, can we repave Old Lancaster Road only if we get $3 million of state aid? And if we get $6 million, we'll repave Old Lancaster and Peckham.
I think the answer to that is that the items that are listed in the budget are the items that will be funded in the event that there is state aid and taxes. If you're asking can we ahead of time tell you what items won't be funded, we can only tell you that unless something is appropriated at the town meeting, it won't be funded. But if there is an item that is funded subject to state aid, that item won't be funded. And I'm sorry if it's a little bit obtuse, but anything that's appropriated under the budget will be funded through taxation, part of which is the state aid. It's an offset from that. If, in fact, we have an item, as the town manager said, which, and this is the stabilization fund that we've discussed, that is funded subject to the receipt of certain state aid, that type of funding will not be funded unless we receive the appropriate type of state aid that we have. But in ordinarily, and that's the type of a contingency vote that is appropriate. Ordinarily, you can't have contingent appropriations on something, you know, if something happens, this will be done. Only where there's a specific amount and a specific item that we anticipate through the state that will come, can you have that contingent arrangement? So anything that's listed as that will not be funded if the appropriation doesn't go through. But unless it's listed that way, it will be funded through the budget as the budget is appropriate. That answer your question?
It does answer my question. Are there any budget items listed as contingent on state aid?
No. Not this time.
No. Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard? Yes. Can we get a mic over? Thank you.
Brian Semple, 15 Revere Road. It's certainly disappointing that we don't have any of the union contracts signed for tonight. So two questions on that. So, first off, we're asking the unions for some significant concessions on health care reform, et cetera, significant savings from that. Have we done anything to combine any of the shared management positions that were identified between SBS, LS, and the town as part of the BRTF report? We're asking the unions for concessions. Have we done anything on the management side to address the cost issue? The second part of my question is...
Hang on one sec. Larry, can you give an answer to that?
Certainly. The short and direct answer is no, nothing has been done yet. The longer answer is that there is a working group that has met approximately four times looking into the recommendations that have been made concerning potential possible cost savings from administration consolidation between the regional high school and the SPS district. But at this point, it's not a fast and easy process. It will take some study, and the group is looking at that right now.
Thank you. What is your second question?
Second question. So if we don't have a union contract signed, say, this year, what happens in terms of the step and cost of living increases for SPS, LS, and SPS, assuming we don't have a signed union agreement? What would happen in lieu of a contract for next year?
I think the contracts continue as they are, which means the steps continue. However, there are no COLAs provided for after the contracts expire. So going into this next fiscal year, you would have steps but no COLAs.
Across all three groups?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else wish to be heard on the motion under Article 4? Yes. Right over there. Could you stand, please? The mic's in front of you. Could somebody stand?
Susan Giuliano in Sudbury School Committee. Just to clarify that in the event that a contract is not in place by July 1st, the steps and lanes may not go into effect on July 1st for the Sudbury Public Schools.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard on the motion to Article 4? I see, yes, right over there.
Martha Cole, 14 Churchill Street. If we get into an override situation, do we have to go through an election procedure by the 30th of June?
I'm sorry, do we have to go through an election procedure by when?
30th of June this year.
No.
Thank you.
There will be a general election if an override passes the town meeting, but not necessarily by June 30. Anybody else wish to be heard on the motion under Article 4, the budget? I see none. All those in favor of the motion as shown in the blue card signify by raising your cards. All those opposed? It is nearly unanimous. It passes overwhelmingly. We're going to go through now Articles 5, 6, 7, and 8, and I believe we're going to see the same motion to refer. And then when we finish Article 8, we're going to jump to Article 23 and try to finish all the non-moneyed articles tonight. Before I do that, I would like to introduce two guests we have in our audience tonight. One is our state rep, Tom Conroy. You raise your hand there. And our newest employee, and I'm pleased to say joint employee with the town of Wayland, we have Nancy McShay. You can stand. No, Nancy, you got to stand up and face the hall. FinCom for a motion under Article 5.
Move to refer Article 5 to the Board of Selectmen to determine the effect of the state budget relative to state aid to Sudbury and to report back to this annual town meeting in an adjourned session on June 15, 2009 for further action on this article.
Does it receive a second? It does. FinCom, you have the same report?
Same report.
Selectmen, same report?
Same.
Anybody wish to be heard on the motion under Article 5? I see no hands. All those in favor signify by raising your cards. All those opposed? That passes unanimously. FinCom for a motion under Article 6.
Move to refer Article 6 to the Board of Selectmen to determine the effect of the state budget relative to state aid to Sudbury and to report back to this annual town meeting and an adjourned session on June 15, 2009 for further action on this article.
Does it receive a second? It does. FinCom, same report.
Same report.
Selectmen, same report.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Anybody wish to be heard on the motion under Article 6? Yes, please. Stand.
Robert Coe, 14 Churchill Street. Since this enterprise fund is essentially revenue neutral, what possible effect could the state budget decisions have on the operation of the enterprise fund? Why is it necessary to delay this or any of the other enterprise fund budgets contingent on action by the state?
Just for the purposes of keeping all budget-related articles in one neat package.
I'm sorry, there's one other piece.
Yes, town manager?
We vote the benefits, even though they're funded, revenues, they're voted under Article 4. It's all one package. So for the enterprise fund, that's where the benefits for those employees are voted. So they work together.
Anybody else wish to be heard on the motion on the Article 6? I see none. All those in favor of the motion on the view grad signify by raising your cards. All those opposed, that is also unanimous. Article 7, Finance Committee.
Move to refer Article 7 to the Board of Selectmen to determine the effect of the state budget relative to state aid to Sudbury and to report back to this annual town meeting at an adjourned session on June 15th, 2009 for further action on this article.
Does that receive a second? It does. Finance Committee have the same report?
Yes, same report.
Selectmen
yes.
have the same report?
Yes, sir.
They do. Anybody wish to be heard under this motion? I see no hands. All those in favor of the motion of the view graph signify by raising your cards. Those opposed? That passes unanimously. Article 8, Finance Committee.
Move to refer Article 8 to the Board of Selectmen to determine the effect of the state budget relative to state aid to Sudbury and to report back to this annual town meeting at an adjourned session on June 15, 2009 for further action on this article.
Does that receive a second? It does. Finance Committee have the same report?
Same report.
Yes.
Selectmen have the same report?
Yes, sir.
Anybody wish to be heard on the motion of the Article 8? I see none. All those in favor signify by raising your cards. Those opposed? It is unanimous. We now go to Article 23. We have already taken care of all the articles up to 23. And we'll call on Chris Morley, chairman of the CPC, Community Preservation Committee, who will make a motion.
Move in the words of the article with the sum of $208,000 appropriated.
Does that receive a second? It does. Mr. Morley.
The presentation of this will be made by Mike Fee, the chairman of the Housing Trust, the Sudbury Housing Trust.
That's Michael Fee, chairman of the Sudbury Housing Trust.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Thank you, Mr. Morley. Good evening. My name is Michael Fee, 48 Henry's Mill Lane. I'd like to tell you briefly about the Housing Trust.
Mike, you have to get a little closer to the microphone.
Sorry. I'd like to speak to you briefly tonight about the Housing Trust activities this past year and describe some of the projects that we're going to be working on in fiscal year 10. You may recall that the trust was first created by vote of town meeting in 2006, and it was funded by similar CPC articles at town meetings in 07 and 08. And we are here tonight, as Mr. Morley mentioned, seeking our annual appropriation of the CPC funds. As many of you know, the real driver behind the trust activities is Massachusetts General Laws Chapter 40B, which provides that every community in the Commonwealth must take steps to ensure that at least 10% of its housing stock is affordable, a term generally defined to mean within the reach of a family making 80% of the area mean income. Now, 40B, in its practical sense, means that if a town does not take steps to try to achieve this affordability status, then its zoning bylaws may be disregarded by developers who agree to set aside certain portions of their developments for affordable housing. Now, over the years, I've learned that there are widely divergent views in Sudbury as to the utility of affordable housing, and I certainly recognize that, but I think the fact that we have differing views regarding whether or not affordable housing is a good thing doesn't really change the realities of 40B. If we don't, as a community, take steps to try to achieve our 10% affordability status and try to meet those goals on our own terms through the work of the trust, then we subject ourselves to the whims of developers who may not necessarily be in tune to the particular local needs or unique character of the town. And that's what the trust strives to do. is to create this affordable housing within the context and the aesthetics that we all seem to agree on. Now, next slide, please. Just a brief overview of where we stand in terms of affordability, the statistics show that the average home price in Sudbury is about $680,000, and now more than ever, home ownership is further and further beyond the reach of many individuals in the municipal and service sectors who just can't afford to live and work here in Sudbury. At present, we have approximately 260 affordable units in town, and of those, as a result of the programs administered by the trust, six are currently owned by their occupants. And as I mentioned, the trust strives to develop home ownership options for these affordable buyers. The average annual income of these individuals who own their own homes in Sudbury, approximately $60,000. And certainly without the trust support, these types of home ownership opportunities just would not be available. So how do we do this? How do we achieve our mission? There's several distinct programs that we target and work on. The first is home preservation. The trust utilizes funds to purchase deed restrictions on existing homes and convert them to affordable home ownership in perpetuity. And what that means is that what we try to do is when we see a home of good quality and good character that is a target for a teardown, we will go in and purchase with trust funds a deed restriction on that home, thereby saving it for home ownership by an affordable person qualified for the affordable home ownership program. And we've done that, I think we had three of those last year, and we plan to continue that program in 2010. The next thing that we do is small developments, and you may have noticed that we purchased a parcel located at the corner of Pratt's Mill and Dutton Road last year, and we've been working over the past year with Habitat for Humanity to develop a duplex affordable home ownership on that site. The construction is now nearly complete, and we're very proud of this because the partnership with Habitat for Humanity has really developed a lot of positive interaction among various folks in the community, and we are actively searching for other opportunities to replicate this particular model in Sudbury. Currently, also on small developments, we're working on the Maynard Road project, and you may have seen that we purchased a lot with that had a dilapidated structure on it on the corner of Maynard, Marlborough, and Fairbanks Roads. That structure has been removed, and we have done pre-development due diligence, architectural design, and we're currently in the RFP process trying to locate a developer who will actually build this project. And if you take a look, it's a very interesting design that we've come up with, and with the help of a very famous architect. And what we're going to do is produce six affordable units within this project, and we hope to have this built in 2010. I know I'm about to get the hook. Am I?
No.
Okay, sorry.
That was not my hearing aid battery. That was actually 5 minutes. You have 10.
Oh, excellent. Thank you. Well, I'll wrap it up quicker than that. We also utilize small grants, and this is one of my favorites among the projects that we do. We launched this program last year, and what we do is we utilize trust funds to provide financial grants, no strings attached, of up to $3,000 to eligible folks in town, mostly seniors, who need help with maintenance issues in their home. I think a very palpable way, this is a way of utilizing the trust funds to assist folks with the repair, maintenance, and upkeep of their property, and thereby enabling them to maintain home ownership in these affordable units. Finally, we established the Community Housing Office with a dedicated staff professional in the person of Beth Rust, who is sitting over here. She is a very active and energetic person. She provides a lot of knowledge and information to the folks in town that are interested in taking advantage of these projects. So we're looking for $208,000, which is the 10% CPA mandated allocation. I've also brought along the trust balance sheet, which gives sort of a snapshot of the activities that we did last year. Certainly a much more detailed financial analysis is available from Ms. Rust if you're interested at the planning office. Basically, we took in last year $750,000 from CPA funds. We spent about half of it. and we have approximately $700,000 available. Looking towards 2010, we anticipate expending approximately $500,000 to $600,000 of the available funds on the projects that I've just described. So when considering your vote on whether to approve this article, please remember that the state requires that we pursue this 10% affordable housing goal. We and the trust believe it's our duty to strive to reach that goal. And through a variety of the programs that we've described, we've been successful in the past in creating home ownership opportunities for a great number of people in town. We think it has direct public benefit, and we would urge you to support the article.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jim Rayo for a support report on the Finance Committee.
The Finance Committee recommends approval of Article 23.
Mr. O'Brien for the Board of Selectmen.
The Board of Selectmen unanimously supports, Mr. Moderator.
Anybody wish to be heard on the article under the motion under Article 23? Yes, is that you all the way in the back? Please rise, and the Boy Scout will get you a mic.
The view graph said that there was about $750,000 of income, but this says 10% is $200,000 or $208,000. Where is that discrepancy?
Last year, we came before town meeting and we asked for 10% CPA allocation and then an additional $500,000, which town meeting voted to deliver to us. So the income that we got last year of $750,000 was well beyond the 10% CPA allocation and well beyond what we're seeking this year. Does that answer your question?
So the CPA funds, is that from the fees that are assessed on sales of homes?
Correct.
Yes, it does.
Thank you.
Mr. Fee, is it from the CPA funds, is it from fees on sales of home or from just an addition to the tax rate? And that's how you get the money. Thank you. Yeah. Yes, Mike. Yes, over there, please.
And Jim Negrelli, 51 Penny Meadow Road. I was just curious, what defines progress for meeting this 10% requirement? Do we have to show something in terms of money or percentage to show that we're progressing towards the 10% goal?
Yes, Mr. Fee.
Sorry, can you repeat the question?
Yes, I think your last slide noted something about that Sudbury needs to show that we're progressing towards or trying to meet the 10% goal.
Right.
I think an earlier slide before that mentioned that we're at 4.7%. My question has to do, what does Sudbury have to show that we are progressing towards trying to attain the 10%? Is it just allocating money every year to this, or is it actually building homes? What will happen if we don't attain the 10%? Thank you.
The sword of Damocles won't fall on us if we don't attain the 10%. But the way it generally works in practical terms is that when developers come to town and try to do a 40B project and there is a denial by the Zoning Board of Appeals, that denial can be immediately taken to the Housing Appeals Committee, which is an appellate division of the Commonwealth. One of the criteria that the Housing Appeals Committee utilizes in determining whether the local zoning board's decision to deny the 40B project was appropriate is whether or not the town has a program in place designed to promote affordable housing. And if it does not, it is presumed that that town is not taking steps to reach its affordability goal. And so it's not a hard and fast rule about how you are to attain the 10% affordability status, but a variety of activities tends to support a town's position that it is indeed taking good faith efforts to achieve affordability status. Does that answer your question?
Yep. Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 23? I see none. This requires a majority vote. All those in favor of the motion on Article 23 signify by raising your cards. Those opposed, it passes overwhelmingly, almost a unanimous vote. Article 24, Chris Morley.
Move in the words of the article, except that the work is to be performed under the direction of the town manager with the involvement of the town clerk and the Sudbury Historical Commission with the amount of $170,000 appropriated and funded from FY10 revenue.
Does that receive a second? It does.
This presentation will be made by Rosemary Harvell, the town clerk.
And this requires a majority vote.
Hello. Our town is very fortunate that from its very beginning, town officials...
Rosemary, in order for us to keep a record, can you get a little closer to the mic?
Okay. Yes. Can you hear me now? Our town is very fortunate that from its very beginnings, the town officials carefully recorded all the activities and official acts of the town and its residents and took very great care to preserve the records that were created. Sudbury has an unbroken chain of historic records dating back to 1638. These ancient records survived the fire on February 5, 1930, when the town hall burned to the ground. The records survived because the town had a vault that protected the ancient records from the heat. And although the fire chief had to guard the vault for 2 days and nights before the vault was cool enough to open safely, the records were preserved. Sudbury has a proud history of protecting its town records. This article, if passed, would provide funds for the repair, stabilization, conservation, and archival quality storage boxes for 16 volumes of historic records dating back from the 17th, 18th, 19th, and early 20th century. Amongst the documents needing attention, these books were identified and chosen as the most frequently handled and therefore at the highest immediate risk of suffering further permanent loss. Oh, you're moving along. Okay, thank you. So you can look up here. You can see some of the records that, I don't know, that you've been seeing. You can see foxing, which the acid destroys the paper. There's some of the ink has faded. And further along, I'll show you some other problems that we've had. Some of the books were treated in the past, in the 1930s and 1940s. So you can see the fading on this one. And then the next one. And some of the, there's dirt and foxing and destruction on that. And then what's the next slide? And here's a close-up of that. But in the 1930s and 40s, various ancient volumes were treated with the emery process. And that's called silking. And what that does is you have paper that's in danger of really just disintegrating. And what they did is they bonded silk to the front and back of the pages with adhesive and to protect the pages from tearing and damage from handling. This was state of the art at the time, and it actually did provide protection to the records, much in the same way as Scotch tape does when we keep paper intact by using that. The use of the emery process may very well be the reason that some of the records still exist in our archives today. However, it's now known that the silking process and the adhesives used are unstable and destructive and cause irreversible damage to the paper documents. The silk must be removed or the records will deteriorate beyond repair. Next slide. This is one of the books in the silking. It's actually keeping a couple of different pieces together, and there's actually silk on both sides of those. And the next one. And here you can see it's suspended, the pages, between the silk. It's very important. Is the next one? I think the next one is one more. There's another one here. And it's hard to read, but the silk is actually destroying the paper, even though it preserved it temporarily. Now we can preserve it more fully, but we have to take the silk off. It's very important for a conservator to document the treatment of our records. And that's what this gentleman is doing in this picture. And it's to prepare a written and photographic record of his treatment. And that's really required part of a responsible conservation treatment for materials of value. The purpose of the documentation is to document the appearance and condition of the book prior to treatment, describe the treatment that was done to it, specify the materials that were used, and it's also to identify which books have been treated for our records and provide information that's helpful to conservators who may in the future treat that book further, especially as new and improved techniques and materials become available, as is in the case now with the when we know that silking has to be reversed. Next slide. Here you can see in this slide they're removing adhesives and some old repairs off of a book. Past repairs may have been made with materials now known to be harmful, such as rubber cement and most tapes, and they should be removed. Repairs that were made using water-based adhesives can be removed with a water bath, with moisture or with steam. And many synthetic adhesives and pressure-sensitive tapes require the use of an organic solvent for removal. Here, this is actually removing silk from a document. In our cases, most of these records are on highly acidic paper, and they have to be deacidified. And the next slide. And this is one method. He's actually spraying the book here. The deacidification of acidic paper, conservation practice to neutralize acids, and actually they deposit in the paper a buffer that will protect it from formation of acid in the future. Also, washing by aqueous solutions. In the next picture. This is another method they use. Also, if the book isn't too bad, they can remove superficial grime, dirt, soot, and with a soft brush or a powdered eraser, insect specks and mold residue may have to be removed mechanically with a small tool like a spatula. Or in the case of mold, it has to be vacuumed out. Okay, prior to doing any of these, the washings, the ink and the color have to be carefully tested for see if it's soluble to make sure that the media is stable and it won't fade or blur during the treatment. Okay. Here, many times it requires the books to be taken apart and disbinded. And this is actually, they're repairing that and putting it back together. If there's tears in the pages or leaves, it can be carefully aligned and repaired with thin strips of Japanese paper and or other adhesive or starch paste, or by inlaying with paper similar to the original in weight, texture, and color. Now, several of our books were required, especially you saw the ones that have the silk on them. They can't stand on their own. They're too fragile. And that requires encapsulating them when they're very weak or brittle in polyester film and then post-binding it. The polyester film is a clear, inert plastic that provides excellent support for fragile paper. And each leaf of the book is placed in between two sheets of this film, and then it's sealed along all four of the edges of the plastic. And this is a case here. I don't know if you can see it very well, see the pages inside the film there. And then they have a post binding so that the posts are actually put through the polyester film, and then they make it into an album. And the final step is archival boxes, and that's included in this article as well. It's crucial to the preservation of many of the books. The boxes for a book, they provide structural support and protection from dust and dirt, light, mechanical damage for use, and to some extent fluctuations in humidity. They need to be constructed of durable materials, conservation quality, and should be custom made to fit a book's dimensions exactly. And this article provides for custom archival boxes to house each of these volumes upon completion of the treatment, repair, and conservation. Go to the next slide. And this is a figure showing the types of boxes that they've made. Now, this is an interesting note. The Declaration of Independence is in Sudbury's Town Records. After the Founding Fathers inked the Declaration of Independence in the summer of 1776, the Second Continental Congress directed congressional delegations to inform their fellow citizens back home. The Massachusetts Executive Council, which helps oversee the Massachusetts colony, including parts of what is now Maine, commissioned a private printer in Salem to produce between 200 and 300 of the Declaration of Independence broadsides. They were to be read aloud by the ministers in various towns and delivered to each town's clerk. The clerks were then to copy the broadside's text into their respective town records to remain as a perpetual memorial thereof. And that is in Book 6, Sudbury Town Records, is the Declaration of Independence written in right before it's, can't read it. It's right after, like it was a town meeting in July beginning, and then they wrote it right in there. And the next slide is a little bit of a close-up of it. Now, the last thing that is done after we preserve the records is to digitize them. Digital copies of records play an important role in preservation as surrogates by protecting fragile and valuable originals from handling and at the same time allowing access to their content to a vastly increased audience. But digitizing is not preservation. It is a means of copying original materials. And what it does is we can put them on the internet for people to access and see the original documents without actually causing damage. I urge you to support this article. Thank you.
Thank you. Sheila Stewart of the Finance Committee.
Thank you.
Finance Committee recommends approval of this article.
Bill Keller for the Board of Selectmen.
The Selectmen unanimously support this, this article, and quite frankly, with the importance of history to our community, without preserving our records as we age and our memories aren't quite as good, we'll run the risk of losing our history. And we'd hate to see that happen.
This requires a majority vote. Anybody wish to be heard on Article 24? Yes, please stand. Can you bring this mic right to the middle here?
Adam Miller, 1 Knobscot Road. I was just wanted to inquire about the current storage facilities for these for the records and whether or not they're up to par to not contribute to any further deterioration once we expend this money to preserve the documents.
That actually, there are concerns about the climate control of the for the records, and that is something that we're going to address after this is completed, and but the archival boxes will contribute a lot to the stabilization of their environment. It's not something that would be as urgent, but conserving these books is very urgent. If you open them up, they actually make your eyes sting because they're so acidic. So the first thing we really need to do is way past time to conserve them, to repair them, and deacidify the papers. Does that answer your question? Thank you.
Anybody else wish to be heard on the Article 24? Yes, right there, please.
James Hill, 199 Concord Road, also Vice Chairman of the Sudbury Historical Commission, and I'd like to say we strongly support the preservation of these documents.
Thank you. Can you pass the mic behind you? Thank you.
Martha Cole, 14 Churchill Street. Last sentence of the article up on the view graph says from fiscal year 10 revenue, and the warrant says it's from CPA Historic Fund. It would seem to me that if the fiscal 10 revenue is so iffy, and we also want this, we would want it from CPA.
Thank you, Mr. Morley, CPA CPC Chairman.
I'm glad to hear your support, Mrs. Coe. This is from CPA funds, which are not iffy. And actually, the Historic Commission has, or the historical section of the CPA has a large backlog of monies that they have not spent yet. This is to come out of this coming year's historic percentage of our revenue. There's no concern about the revenue for this year.
So it's coming from CPC funds for the next fiscal year. Thank you. Anyone else have any questions or comments on Article 24? I see none. All those in favor of the motion on the view graph signify by raising your cards. Those opposed. It passes with one exception overwhelmingly. We're now going to move on to, before we move to Article 25, just to let you all know, there's three articles that we're not going to hear tonight because we've already dealt with them. So we just have a few more left. Article 25, Mr. Morley.
Move in the words of the article with the amount of $18,000 appropriated.
Does that receive a second? It does.
Dr. Maurice Fitzgerald, I believe, is presenting.
Right to your left.
Aha. There he is.
Morris Fitzgerald, 108 Old Lancaster Road. I'm a member of the Sudbury Historical Commission, and we propose this article. It's really divided in two parts. The first part is for the continuation of our survey of existing structures in Sudbury. Over the years, we've surveyed and identified, located, and described numerous structures here in Sudbury. The town assessors gave us a list of buildings built prior to 1900. There was 195 buildings here in town. We have already identified with the Massachusetts Historic Commission forms about 140 of those. That leaves us about 50 to 60 more houses to put into our survey. We use a form that was given to us by the Massachusetts Historical Commission. This requires a photograph of the house, a map showing its location, an identification of the year it was built, a description of the house now, and a list of the alterations done through the years as well as we can document. Then in addition to that, we have an architectural description of the house and a historical narrative. All of these procedures are done by a professional preservationist now, I guess is their title. And the money that is proposed for this part of this article involves the work or the contracts with the different preservationists and the printing of the results of this survey. The second part of this article is for the restoration of the cemeteries that are on the west side of Concord Road in Sudbury Center, up the hill from the Revolutionary War statue. We've already repaired and done a terrific job on the Revolutionary War Cemetery, which is the one adjacent to the Grange, the church, and the town hall. This is on the opposite side of the street. There it was some question by some people whether this fell into the preservation funds for the perpetual care of these stones. No, it does not. These were stones mostly from the 19th century and were before we had any kind of perpetual care funds for them. So I move in the words of the article.
Thank you, Dr. Fitzgerald. Sheila Stewart, Finance Committee.
Finance Committee unanimously supports this article.
Unanimous support of the Finance Committee. John Drabinski for the Board of Selectmen.
Yes, thank you, Ms. Moderator. The Board of Selectmen unanimously support this article. Thank you.
Anybody wish to be heard under Article 25? I see no one. All those in favor of the motion and the view graph signify by raising your cards. Those opposed. It is a unanimous vote. We now move to Article 26. Mr. Morley.
Move to appropriate $229,000 from community preservation funds, as recommended by the Community Preservation Committee, for the purpose of restoring the exterior of the Loring Parsonage with associated work, said appropriation to be allocated to the historic category and funded from historic reserves.
Does that receive a second? It does.
This presentation will be by the Sudbury Historical Commission, Liz Radosky.
Liz Radosky.
Liz Radowski, 358 Old Lancaster Road, a member of the Sudbury Historic Commission. This motion is different from what's printed in the warrant by two things. One, we have announced the amount of money that we are requesting as $229,000, and we have added the words "with associated work" after the purpose of restoring the exterior of the Loring Parsonage. I'm here before you to ask you to support the Loring Parsonage article as correctly changed. The pictures that you are seeing on the screen were done by Jim Kelly, and I'd like to thank him for that. 2 years ago, this body voted and approved an article to put a roof on the parsonage, some clapboard replacement on the part of one side of the building, updating the electrical systems, and bringing in computer network lines for $72,000. The electrical and computer network lines were completed for $4,000. The bidding process identified more work that needed to be done, and the invitation for bids was withdrawn. The rest of the funds, $68,000, were returned to the CPC Reserve Historic Funds. The town uses CPC administrative funds in April 2008 and started the process anew and issued an invitation to bid as the architect on the Loring Historic Preservation Restoration Project. E.R. Rasek Associates of Boston won the contract. The Permanent Building Committee, the Historic Commission, and the Building Inspector have worked hand in glove on this project with E.R. Rasek Associates. We have received a certificate of appropriateness from the Sudbury Historic District. The bidding process is complete, and the winner has been identified. We are awaiting your approval tonight on this article so we can award this contract. A little history of the parsonage for Newtown members. The parsonage was built in 1723, and it was the home of Reverend Israel Loring. He was the parson hired by the town to be its pastor in 1705. When Whalen and Sudbury separated into two church locations, he moved to this side of the river in 1723. He lived in this house till his death at age 90. During these years, he ministered at town meetings and to the citizens of Sudbury. Mary Haynes, the daughter of Israel Loring, married Wheeler Haynes, a descendant of one of Sudbury's first families. The Haynes family had a farm and a dairy business on the land. The parsonage was privately owned by them till the town bought it in 1930. It was occupied then by the town custodian, later by Leo Quinn, the town fireman, and from the late 60s as the selectmen's and town offices until their move to the Flynn Building. It is currently the home of the Lincoln Sudbury Credit Union. It is located between the town hall and the Flynn Building on Old Sudbury Road. What do we plan to do is your question, I'm sure. The plans for the CPC restoration include a new cedar shingle roof, new cedar clapboards with the proper reveal for a home built in the 1800s. The trim and the molding and sideboard trims will be replicated when they're missing and restored around the house. The gutters will be removed and a new drainage system installed. Insulation will be added in the attic. The windows that were replaced in the late 1960s from 6/6 design to the 12/12 design will have their mechanisms restored, their panes corked, and the frames restored as needed. The front door will be replaced by a Georgian door with a glass transom appropriate to the period. The side door, which was originally an entrance to the carriage house, removed in 1960, will be closed, boarded, and sided with clapboards. The next side door will be configured to be a handicapped accessible, and the design will match the doors on the opposite side of the building. The remaining doors will be restored. The bulkhead door at the back of the house will be replaced. A brick path will be built in the style of the front walkway to the handicapped entrance. Lead paint will be removed following Massachusetts state requirements. Landscaping will be appropriate to the time period. All the work will be done in a historically accurate period, colors, and workmanship. How can we pay for this? Next question. The funding for this project is in the Historic Restoration Preservation. It has contained in it now the money that we returned, $68,000, and it has also the money that we will need. It is already in the budget. We need now $229,000. When we went out for our initial estimates, we thought we were going to need $300,000, and we waited till we had that much money in the bank to pay for this bill. We're thrilled that we're in 25% less, but of course that comes at an expense. That's what's going on in the economy to all of us, and nobody is thrilled with that. These funds are available to restore the Loring Parsonage. The pictures you've been watching show you the need for the project. This body has previously recognized this need. The funding is available, it's in the bank, and I hope that you approve the restoration of the Loring Parsonage and return it to its former glory. Thank you.
Thank you. Sheila Stewart for the FinCom.
Finance Committee unanimously supports this article.
John Dravinsky for the Board of Selectmen.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Moderator. Board of Selectmen unanimously support this article. Thank you.
Anyone wish to be heard on the motion under Article 26? Can you raise your hand, please? Can you get a mic up to the gentleman, please? All the way up.
Roger Nichols, 220 Old Lancaster Road. Can you just explain again where the money came from?
Sure. There is a CPA program here in town. Unfortunately, I gave a whole speech about it at the first town meeting, which was postponed, so I apologize for that. It is available on the town website, live and written. The CPA program here in town collects money two ways. It charges the 3% surcharge on your tax bill after certain amounts are exempted, and then there is a matching grant from the state. And it has to be spent in four different areas, and the historic area has been gaining money that has to be spent on historic that has yet to be spent, and this is where it's coming from.
Is this already in the $1.5 million or whatever it was that was in the bank from the CPA that we saw back in April 23?
Yes, part of the almost $7 million, yep.
So this is spending the money that exists in the CPA funds today?
Yes.
Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 26? Yes, please stand so we can get your mic.
Grant Grummer, 15 Pine Street. What do we use this building for? For example, this year, what has it been used for?
Presently being used as the home of the Lincoln Sudbury Credit Union.
Yes, Mr. Coe. We're going to go back there first. Hang up. Go ahead, Mr. Coe. You're recognized. Town Manager, Maureen Valente.
Thank you. The town has a lease agreement with the credit union that basically has them paying the operating costs of the building, the utilities, et cetera, so that the building continues to be occupied since the time that the selectman's office moved out of there. Our concerns were that if it's not occupied, you end up with a lot of problems, and the town then is stuck with paying those utilities. So and we just renewed a two-year agreement to continue having the credit union in the building.
Thank you. Yes, all the way in the back.
Tammy Dufault, 84 Silver Hill Road. Just a follow-up to Maureen's question, because I was actually going to ask something similar to the gentleman prior to me. Are there any expenditures or any expenses borne by the town for this facility beyond what LS is currently paying?
Yes, Maureen.
I don't believe so. The entity pays all of its operating costs that's in there for that, and so at this point it sort of just relieves us of some of the white elephant costs. It's certainly a historic building that we want to maintain, but right now there's no out-of-pocket cost to us. It's the credit union's paying those to at least keep those off the town tax roll.
Anyone else wish to be heard on the Article 26? I see none. All those in favor of the motion on the view graph signify by raising your cards. Those opposed. It is a unanimous vote. We'll now move on to Article 27. Before the motion on that, I'd like you to know that Articles 28, 29, and 30 have already been taken care of on the consent calendar. So after this article, we just move on to Articles 31 and 32, and we are done. We will adjourn to June 15th. Mr. Morley.
Move in the words of the article.
Is there a second? It does.
The presentation by the planning director, Jody Kaplak.
Good evening. I'm Jody Kaplak, the director of planning and community development, and I'm speaking on behalf of the town manager. Article 27 requests authorization to use up to $25,000 of the funds remaining in the account under Article 24 of the 2007 annual town meeting, and this will enable us to continue with the development of a concept plan for the Bruce Freeman Rail Trail. Article 24 of 2007 authorized up to $105,000 to conduct an environmental resource delineation and existing conditions base map of the railroad right-of-way, which is currently owned by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and is known as the Bruce Freeman Rail Trail. In 2007, the town went out to bid for this work and awarded a contract to Atlantic Engineering for $52,000 to complete the work. And this leaves $53,000 unexpended in this article. So we are asking for a reallocation of approximately $25,000 of that money to be spent to develop a concept plan for the corridor. And then the remainder of the funds will revert back into the Community Preservation Fund. Let me briefly summarize where we're at with the rail trail at this time, including the expenditures that the town has made. In 2005, town meeting authorized $25,000 for an engineering feasibility study of the corridor, and that's been completed. In 2007, town meeting authorized a title search, a four-season wildlife study, and the baseline survey at a total cost of $145,000. The title search has been completed, and the wildlife study has been documented over 4 years, and we are awaiting submittal of the final report. The survey is near completion, and all four of these studies were completed by independent consultants. Once the final work products are delivered, there are no other consultants that are under contract to provide any more information to the town on the rail trail. So it was decided that this is an opportune time to pull back from hiring any more consultants and to take an internal look at the corridor and assess its most likely development. There are many options for the corridor, and now we have some definitive information on its environmental and physical limitations. The town manager has asked the staff, Bill Place, the director of public works, Debbie Dineen, the conservation coordinator, and I, to take some time to evaluate the data that we've recently received, review the most sensitive issues surrounding development of a rail trail, and propose some solutions or alternatives. We all believe that this internal review by people who know the issues and have intimate knowledge of the town's regulations may produce a viable concept for the trail that can then be discussed with both the residents and the state. With our expertise, we hope to evaluate impacts to wetlands, estimate costs of bridges and necessary infrastructure, and propose some creative solutions and to the conventional designs that have been discussed, and then to hold public meetings on our findings. The funds on this article are proposed to be used in areas where we don't have specific expertise, possibly hiring a traffic engineer to assist with road crossings along the rail trail, to hire an engineer to create additional maps and cross-sections of problematic areas, or to possibly further utilize the skills of the wildlife biologist to propose solutions to mitigate any potential impacts of development of the corridor. Since 2005, the town has spent $170,000 on feasibility studies for the corridor, and every article debated at town meeting has been passed overwhelmingly. We believe this indicates that the town supports the concept of developing some sort of recreational trail along this corridor. We also believe that the town wants a trail that enhances our natural resources and is safe. The next step taken by most communities, not by Sudbury, evidenced by our neighboring towns of Acton and Concord, is to spend significant funds to design a rail trail to the Mass Highway Department standards.
That has cost those communities in the range of $160,000 to $250,000. This process that we're entertaining right now will cost us up to $25,000. We propose to defer any major design costs to a time when we know what we want for the trail and can present that concept to the state for approval. We believe that this is a cost-effective solution to pursue at this time, and we urge passage of the article. Thank you.
Finance Committee?
Finance Committee recommends approval.
Mr. Keller for the Board of Selectmen?
The Selectmen also recommend approval.
Anybody wish to be heard on the Article 27? Yes, over there, please.
Jim Negrelli, 51 Penny Meadow Road. In the article, it notes that the town staff will be engaged in formulating ideas about what such a trail might look like and how it might be used or maintained. I'm just wondering if the town will be asking or allowing the public to attend or participate in any of these meetings. I think it would be a nice opportunity for the town residents to understand what the town staff are thinking about. And if not, why? I have another question also, if you want me to wait.
Why don't we answer the first question, and then you can hang on to the mic and go on to your second question.
Yes, of course, absolutely. We'll be entertaining comments both through the Rail Trail Conversion Advisory Committee, and also we do hope to hold public meetings. We want this to be an open process in a collaborative way, one that doesn't just bring an engineering consultant into the process and says, this is the way your trail should look. So we absolutely will be holding public meetings.
Okay. It'll be formally announced and whatnot?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, great. My other question has to do basically, in light of the current economic environment, we've been told that state and federal funding for this project is really not available, and that it probably won't be available in the foreseeable future. From the feasibility study, it was acknowledged that a simple 5-foot stone dust trail might cost up to $3 million. A paved trail could cost over $4 million. And it looks like estimates coming out of Acton and Concord, we might be looking at almost $2 million a mile to build a trail. My question has to do, if the funding isn't available, would the town consider building a $3 or $8 million trail on its own?
I'm not sure that I'm the one to ask that question.
The reason why I ask, if not, why should we be spending additional money? It seems like almost every year we're asking it for a little bit more and a little bit more. And if we really need state and federal money to help us build this trail, why are we continually asking for money to build this rail trail? We have the Assabet Wildlife Refuge, which is going to be opening up, and they have miles of paved trail that are going to be available for biking. And recently, the East-West Trail, known as the Wayside Rail Trail, the MBTA just leased a portion of that trail to the Department of Conservation and Recreation for free. And I'm just wondering if maybe we should be looking at some of the other alternatives available to biking in Sudbury before spending additional money.
Board of Selectmen, Mr. O'Brien.
I think the answer, Mr. Negrelli, is that, first off, if any decision were to be made concerning whatever the price tag might be, for the sake of discussion, we'll use your example of $8 million, that certainly would be a question that would be put forth to this body, town meeting. The expenditure of the $25,000 is a very prudent and cost-effective way to continue the process, and if the plans are developed, if the plans to go ahead are developed and then the decision to actually build a rail trail is delayed until the economy becomes better, funding comes back from state and federal sources, those are all decisions that could be made, and the plan would still more or less remain the same, since there wouldn't be any significant changes anticipated to the trail. But the it has always been stated, and it will always remain the same, the town meeting would be the final body to have the final say on the expenditure of any funds, with or without the inclusion of state and or federal dollars that may or may not be available at any given time.
Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah, I understand that. But technically, I mean, if the money does become available later, we could just simply pick up when we know the money is available instead of spending the money and now we spend it when it's when we know that might the trail the money's available for rail trails might be more feasible.
True. I believe though that it would be fair to say that there's a certain momentum that is currently in place with the Four Seasons study that's been completed. The town manager, in conjunction with the town planner, the conservation coordinator, and the DPW director, have determined that the staff capacity and availability is there now. We don't know what projects they might be busy with or tied up with in the future. So it seems to be that this is a prudent use of time, staff expertise, and to continue the momentum that's underway, and then be at a position where if we have a finished plan ready to go, we can go forward with public hearings, we can decide to put it on the shelf, we can pursue funding. We have many options that would be available on the flowchart after this initial design is put together by staff.
Thank you. Yes, can we have a mic over here in the middle?
Dick Williamson, 21 Pendleton Road. I'd like to comment on the funding process and remind the town that the way these trails are usually done is that the town designs the trail, and then state and federal funds are used to build the trail. Now, a self-fulfilling philosophy is to say that, well, if the funding at the state and federal level is uncertain, we should not proceed with the design. However, if you don't proceed with the design, state and federal funding will not be available. You have to do at least the 25% design to get in the queue for state and federal funding. So you may ask, well, what is the prospect, if we do the design, of state and federal funding coming forward? In fact, the whole situation is rapidly changing at this point. You may think with the economy in the doldrums, it's going downhill. In fact, that's not the case. Several rail trails that had their designs complete were funded instantaneously out of the stimulus funds, and they are proceeding. There is more money going into the transportation budget as part of the economic stimulus for the nation. There's another issue. There was a front page article in the Boston Globe recently pointing out that Massachusetts has the worst record in the nation for the expenditure of so-called enhancement funds. These are funds offered by the federal government for non-motorized transportation. And about 10% of the federal funding is recommended to be used for enhancements. And in other states, roughly half of the enhancements funds have been used for shared use paths. And the rail trail is one type of shared use path. Now, Massachusetts has not taken advantage of these enhancements funds. There's something like $80 million of funds that were available that have not been used by the state. This is becoming such an embarrassment that there is now in the new transportation bill a move to make the use of those funds mandatory and not let the state move to postpone these projects forever and ever. So instead of having like 1% of the federal funds go to things like shared use paths and rail trails, the current number that's being proposed for the new transportation bill, which by the way, the transportation bill is renewed every 5 years, the current numbers are to demand 3% of the federal funding that comes to the state be used for shared use paths. If that comes to fruition, then roughly three times as much money will be available for rail trails as has been the case in the past. To give you an explanation of why or how Massachusetts ranks so poorly, there is an organization that looks at the percentage of enhancement funds going to the various states that are actually used by those states. Massachusetts, as a percentage of the funds, ranks number 50. And in fact, if you include Puerto Rico, Massachusetts is number 51. And it is clear politically that that situation is going to change. I think the prospect for future funding for rail trails is actually quite positive, and I urge the town to proceed. Now, I'm not urging the town to proceed right away with the 25% design. I think this interim motion to keep the process going is very prudent, and I surely hope you support this article.
Yes. Hang on one second. Anyone else wish to be reheard on Article 27? Way in the back.
Roger Nichols, 220 Old Lancaster Road. Can you explain again why spending the $25,000 is going to save us money over what the Mass Highway plan says the rail trail has to look like? In other words, why aren't if the trail gets built to Mass Highway spec, why aren't we just building it to Mass Highway spec, and why are we spending the $25,000 in the first place?
The Mass Highway spec is a much larger design specification that would cost the town somewhere in the range of about $200,000 to $250,000, and it basically ties you into an engineered paved path, and we feel that we're not at that point right now in this town. We haven't really had enough discussions to know whether or not environmentally the corridor can handle a 10-foot wide paved path, and whether politically the town wants it. So we want to do some further just concept designs to see what might fit better with Sudbury. The Mass Highway 25% design, again, is designed to full specification, 10 to 12 feet of paved width.
So this is an investigation of an alternative to the Mass Highway spec?
A series of alternatives. Everything's open.
Thanks.
Okay. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 27? Yes, please stand.
Pat Brown, 34 Whispering Pine Road.
I didn't catch that.
Pat Brown, 34 Whispering Pine Road.
Thank you.
The town planner mentioned that the work product for Article 23 and for Article 24, which is part of the information on which they're going to base their decisions, those work products have not been delivered. Do we have an estimate of when we might expect those?
On Article 27?
These are Article 23 and 24 from 2007 town meeting.
Oh, okay.
The wildlife study, I believe, is just about done. The consultant said that it was being mailed shortly, and I know that it was going directly to the Conservation Commission office, and I know that Debbie Denny is on vacation this week, so I have not seen it. The base map, which is Article 24 of the 2007 town meeting, we've gone back and forth with the surveyor a number of times, and we're working out our final edits on the plan right now. So that should be also done in a month. I don't know. It's taken him a long time every time we've gone back and forth.
Were you going to post those on the town website when they become complete?
The wildlife study is very easy to post on the town website. I don't believe the map will be. It's 13 pages long of an engineered survey map. So that is available, will be available in the town engineering office when it's complete.
And did you have a time frame on the concept plan when that would be available for public discussion?
No, we don't really have a time frame. It's going to be based on our availability of time that Bill, Debbie, and I can work on it, but we're hoping to work on it over the summer and then maybe start doing some public meetings in the fall.
Thank you.
Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 27? Yes, sir.
Dandy Pompey, 35 Haynes Road. I'd just like to add a comment about all this budget funding that was reported to be available for rail trails. While that, in fact, may be true, it should also be understood that there's a great deal of competition for that funding. And, in fact, there are competing plans for rail trails throughout the state, and the state has its own plan for rail trails. And this plan for rail trails was discussed a number of times at the rail trail advisory committee meetings, and it was determined at those meetings that the Sudbury portion of the Bruce Freeman rail trail is not a high priority for funding. In fact, it was a minimum of 10 years before that funding would become available. So I don't want anyone to think that I'm against bicycle trails. I support bicycle trails. But I wouldn't want anyone to think that there's easy money available to construct a rail trail. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else wish to be heard? All the way in the back, please stand. Can we get a mic over there?
Greg Hamill, 16 Pine Street. In 2007, we were assured by the people when they were being funding those the three plans that were set up at the time that they would not come back to town meeting and ask for any more money until all three of those plans were completed and shown to the group.
Anyone else wish to be heard?
Those three articles, they are complete. So we've received all the preliminary data on all of those things, and that's why we are taking it to the next step. So those have been completed to a certain degree. The final work product should be done in the next 30 days or so.
Anyone else wish to be heard on Article 27? I take it that's a rhetorical question. Thank you. Anyone else wish to be heard on Article 27? I see no hands. This requires a majority vote. All those in favor of Article 27 signify by raising your cards. Those opposed? It passes by well more than a majority. We're now moving to Article 31, the next to last article.
Move to appropriate the sums as recommended by the Community Preservation Committee in the following Community Preservation budget for FY10, said sums to be raised by FY10 Community Preservation surtaxes. $95,000 administrative and operating costs, $1,124,454 in debt service, and further to reserve the following funds: $26,979 for historic preservation, $430,567 for budgeted unrestricted CPC uses.
Does that receive a second? It does. Mr. Morley?
I am going to briefly present. This is just when we put the monies in the proper place for the town accountant from all of our articles and our budget revenue. The committee report and your warrant has most of the details. I will point out a few things. As we discussed a month ago, we have to reserve 10% of our budget revenues in each of three categories: open space, community housing, and historic preservation. That reserve is made only if 10% or more has not been spent out of FY10 funds. The debt service number that you see here is mostly for open space, and it's obviously well above the 10% $208,000 number. So that covers the open space money. Earlier we spent for community housing $208,000, and that was their 10% dedicated money. That leaves the historic preservation number that you see being reserved here, which is the remainder of their reserves and the 10% money that we haven't spent. There is no 10% reserve for recreation. The last number is budgeted unrestricted reserves. That's our savings number that can be appropriated by the town meeting for all four categories. So tonight we're actually adding $457,000 to that savings amount, which is climbing close to $7 million. Thank you.
Thank you. Finance Committee?
Finance Committee recommends approval.
Mr. Drabinski for the Board of Selectmen.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Board of Selectmen want to support this article, and would like to thank the CPC for preserving our sense of community. Thank you.
Anybody wish to be heard under Article 31? I see no hands. This requires a majority vote. All those in favor of Article, the motion under Article 31, signify raising your hands. All those opposed. It is a unanimous vote. We'll now move on to Article 32, and Robert Landry will make the motion.
Good evening. Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Robert Landry, 27 Montague Street. I move in the words of the article with the additional language for the sum of $1.
Is there a second? That receives a second. Mr. Landry for a presentation.
The lot referred to in Article 32 is located on Butler Place. If you're familiar with Haskell Field, it's a short road with a handful of houses that runs along the border on the far side of the field from Hudson Road. It's one of two lots that were purchased by from the ears of Joseph and Josephine Bulgari by David Otis, who I'm speaking for tonight.
Excuse me. Can you hear back in the rear? You're all set? Okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
Okay. The purpose of the article is to remove a cloud on title for Lot 4, which has to do with a tax taking that goes back in time, well over 60 years ago. The approval of this article does not create a new building lot, either by itself or in addition with any of the land that's adjoining it. It's presently owned by David Otis, who purchased Lot 4 and another Lot 5, which abuts it, from the heirs of Josephine and Joseph Bulgari. Could I have the first plan, which I think is page 3? As you can see, this is a rather old plan, and this is the best copy I could come up with to provide for the meeting tonight. And it shows 1st and 2nd Street. There is no 1st Street anymore. That basically is part of the land between Haskell Field and the houses on Butler Place, and 2nd Street is what's now known as Butler Place. Looking from right to left, you can see the rectangular portions of the land, and the fourth one in is Lot 4. It's 3,750 square feet. And that lot, along with Lot 3, was sold by Ida Butler, who owned the land and developed it at the time. And she created these lots in 1926, I believe it was. And they were originally sold to a gentleman by the name of Salvatore Brigandi in 1928. After a few years of not paying taxes, the town of Sudbury took lots 3 and 4 for failure to pay taxes, and 3 years later foreclosed on the right of redemption, which basically allows the town to prevent the owner from coming back and paying the back taxes and clearing the land. In 1938, a further step in the process, lots 3 and 4 were conveyed to the town by quitclaim deed by the Commissioner of Corporations and Taxations. For some reason, in 1942, when Joseph Bulgari wanted to acquire the properties by paying the back taxes, the town allowed him to redeem the lots, and there's a document on record at the Registry of Deeds allowing him to redeem the lots 3 and 4. And since that time period, the town of Sudbury treated those lots of land as privately owned and taxed them and collected taxes, and the Bulgaris treated it as their own property and part of their home. In 1944, for some unexplained reason, well, a reason we haven't been able to come up with, Ida Butler, who was still living at the time, conveyed the properties, lots 3 and 4, to Joseph and Josephine Bulgari. And they were owned by the heirs of that family up until last year when they were conveyed to David Otis. Now, prior to the family deeding the properties to Mr. Otis, they made an attempt to have it established as a separate building lot. And because of the state laws and some cases that have been decided regarding grandfathering the lots, the town was not in a position to say, yes, they are a buildable lot. They then went to the Board of Appeals seeking a variance to establish it as a buildable lot, and they were turned down for that variance request. When the title was being reviewed, they approached Mr. Otis and wondered if he was interested in purchasing the land, which he was. Basically, it's additional land. Again, it's not going to create any new lot, new building lot. He was interested, and the title revealed that there was this discrepancy in the tax taking, and where the town had taken the property by quitclaim deed, the proper method back in the 40s would have been to convey the property by deed to Mr. Bulgari. And so this article is here to correct that mistake from 65 years ago, and to remove the cloud on title. Now, in terms of the other possible solutions to this, we could go to the land court and we could ask there to be a quiet title or file a quiet title suit, which would require the town to come in, file an answer, and defend the suit if they wanted to exercise rights in the property. It seemed as though this approach, by bringing the article before town meeting, was a lot simpler process, as well as less expensive for Mr. Otis and less expensive for the town, who presumably would incur some legal fees, at least in reviewing the case and answering it. There are other plans that have established that the town itself recognized that this property is privately owned. Okay, page four. This is from 1954, which was a layout of Butler Place. At the time, there was a proposal that Butler Place be accepted as a public way, and that didn't happen, but there is a plan on file with the Registry of Deeds that shows that the Joseph and Josephine Bulgari are the owners of the property along Butler Road. There is no town-owned land on that stretch of road. This is another plan of land from 1970. Again, there was consideration for taking the land, taking the road as a public way, or showing the layout of it. And again, you can see they misspelled Bulgari, but again, the record owner, as far as the town is concerned, was the Bulgari family. And the next page, please. And then this is an excerpt of the assessor's plans from 1991. You can't read it that well, at least I can't from here, but it shows Francis Floridia, John Bulgari, and Christine Ferrari, who are the heirs of the family. So in essence, we're trying to clear up a cloud on title, not looking to create a building lot. I've already spoken with town council, and there would be a language in the deed itself which would specifically state that the land can't be a separate building lot. It has to be joined with an existing building lot, so it means that it could only be owned by Mr. Otis, who already has a house lot, and or the family on the other side. It could not stand on its own. So.
Thank you. We'll go to the Finance Committee.
The Finance Committee takes no position on this article.
Bill Keller for the Selectmen.
Yes, the Selectmen unanimously support this article. We're satisfied, based upon Mr. Landry's presentation and Town Council's review, that this is an appropriate sort of housekeeping, clerical kind of item to clear up a discrepancy in the documents from many years ago.
Thank you. Anybody wish to be heard on Article? Yes, 32.
Robert Coe, 14 Churchill Street. Mr. Moderator, with all respect, this certainly doesn't sound like a housekeeping clarification to me. What this sounds like is an opportunity to take two tiny lots and make a buildable lot out of them. Yes, the carefully worded statement that this will not create an additional buildable lot, but there is already a buildable lot there, presumably, but it would be difficult to build on without this second lot there. Now, the... it's not clear to me, for example, how many other lots there are in town that are going to come before town meeting in a way like this. To me, this is exactly what a land court was created for. Why a lot of statements here about, well, for some reason we can't determine, or for some reason that isn't clear from the record, and so on. That's not the kind of thing that is appropriate to be discussed at town meeting. I think that a land court is the place to go. If the owner of the land doesn't think it's worth the trouble or worth the expense to go to the land court, then let things ride as they are. I just don't see the point of doing this as it's suggested here tonight.
Anybody else wish to be heard? Yes, Mr. Landry.
Just in response to Mr. Coe's comments, the state law has a minimum requirement of a 5,000-square-foot lot in order for a lot to be a buildable lot under the grandfathering rules. It's already been determined by the town of Sudbury that this lot does not fall under the grandfathering rules. That's why the heirs at law went to the Board of Appeals seeking a variance, which they had so many requirements that they had to ask for in that variance. I don't think it was a hard decision for the Board of Appeals. But this is, it's been taxed by the town of Sudbury since 1942 as privately owned after the back taxes were paid. This doesn't fall into a category where someone's seeking to create an extra buildable lot.
Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 32? Yes, Mr. Coe.
In response, Mr. Moderator, it does sound as though the town is being asked to turn a quitclaim deed into a warranty deed, or at least the effect of same thing.
I'm sorry, if I can just correct that. There is no such thing any longer as a warranty deed. In Massachusetts, there is only quitclaim deeds for these purposes.
Well, what's the difference between a quitclaim deed and a deed in the original presentation? Because it said, well, the right way to have done it would have been to convey a deed, but instead we did it with a quitclaim deed instead.
No, I'm sorry. I misspoke. There's also something called a release deed, and that's what the town will be given if this article passes. There's a quitclaim deed in which the town makes certain covenants with the buyer. A release deed says, I don't know who owns it. If it's us, you can have it. It's a big difference.
So a release deed is weaker than a quitclaim deed?
Weaker for the buyer, stronger for the seller. The seller is not making those covenants, those warranties to the buyer.
Okay. I still think we're being asked to function as a land court here tonight.
Anybody else wish to be heard on? Yes, ma'am. Stand up, please. Can we have a mic here to the front?
Abby Miller, 1 Knobscot Road. I'm just, for the sake of curiosity, I would like to know, if we voted no on this, is it possible that the town owns this property? And if so, like, would somebody build an apartment on it? Like, what would happen if we voted no?
Mr. Moderator, based on my review of the title, the town does not own this property. As a matter of fact, the only thing that the town has with regard to that is a deed of redemption that was granted to one of the people in back title. The town would be granting a release deed. The terms of that release deed would specifically say that no additional lot is or can be in the future created by this transfer or by the lot in and of itself. So that all of the concern, this will not do anything other than clear up a title that was kind of messed up, if you will, in the 30s by virtue of a tax taking, which was not a perfected taking. It was an affidavit of low value, which is not the same thing as a regular tax taking. You know, there's always a cloud on the title when there's an affidavit of low value. So the fact that the town took it, there may have been a problem with the taking in the first place, and this is just going to clear up those inconsistencies in the record.
Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 32? Way in the back, please.
The presentation of Roger Nichols, 220 Old Lancaster Road. The presentation mentioned that the lot in question must be owned by the adjacent lots or something like that. Does this mean that the lot adjacent to would have be able to build closer to the lot lines and, you know, be able to sort of join the two lots together and not have to have the 10-foot setbacks or whatever it is for structures on the property?
Town Council?
The answer is no. There's a building on the lot as it stands, but in order to construct any additions or anything closer to the lot line would require a variance.
Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 32? I see no one else. I'd like to remind the hall that because this is for the transfer of property, this requires a two-thirds vote. All those in favor of the motion, as you see on the view graph, signify by raising your cards. All those opposed, it passes by well more than two-thirds. Do I hear a motion to adjourn this session of the annual town meeting until June 15th, 09 at 7:30 p.m. here at the Ellis Auditorium?
So moved, Mr. Moderator.
Do I hear a second? Thank you. All those in favor signify by raising your cards. Those opposed, it passes unanimously. Thank you all so very much for coming.